This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review. We're going to survey important news from all over the world, and I have with me here some of our writing staff. We'll start with just a little bit of an overview of what we'll be talking about today, starting with Robert Morley.
Hey, good to be here. Today we'll talk about children in schools being told they are gender fluid and some of the implications and ramifications from that.
And also Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you. I'm going to be talking a little bit about a ghost being resurrected by Russian President Vladimir Putin and what the implications of this are.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. Pope has apologized to Protestants for killing a lot of them. This is part of a big push for church unity in the run-up to the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, and that's going to have major geopolitical events as well as being a big deal within the Christian world.
And also from Ed Stone via Skype, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be sharing the recording studio here with Richard Palmer. Well, for my top story, I'm going to be talking about the 2 weeks that have passed since the implementation day of the Iran nuclear deal, and we're going to check out some highlights to see if it's paying off.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and start right with that story? This is our top story for the week, the effects of this Iranian deal. So, Brent, go ahead and take it away.
Well, the article we're referring to, again, is in the Trumpet Weekly this week, and it's by Commentary Magazine, and it's called Iranian Extortion Pays Off. And it's a really interesting piece because it highlights a number of points and of what Iran has been up to in the past 2 weeks of the nuclear deal. It draws the implementation of the nuclear deal. It draws a lot of attention to the last week's travel of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani to Europe, and where he first went to Italy with about 100 different businessmen to conduct a number of business transactions with some big European companies. First, he went to, like I said, to Italy, and then he went to France. After that point, it looked like in Italy he chalked about $18 billion worth of deals up with several different European and Italian businesses. Danieli Steel Group as well. One of them is $5.6 billion with Airbus. It looked like he's got some deals going, and also with Siemens as well, the mobile phone carrier. So there's quite a lot of business action taking place on the European scene. And it was very interesting because it just highlighted how much, well, this article highlights how much Europe was bowing to Iran to get these deals to go through.
Yeah, Mr. Stephen Fleury was talking about that on the Trumpet Daily this morning, and just how desperate they are, how excited they are to have this new market for them to export, to receive the oil from Iranian markets. Suddenly, 2 weeks ago it was illegal. Now they're just going gangbusters.
Yeah, and the speed of these deals is quite stunning. It's at lightning pace that they're working towards signing these things. It looks like a lot of them were in the works before implementation day, and now they're just capping off those preliminary discussions. It was interesting that at the when he went to Italy, you had the Italian government covered up a lot of the naked statues at a museum where Hassan Rouhani was meeting with the Prime Minister Renzi, just to try not to offend the Iranians, and they weren't going to do anything to jeopardize these lucrative deals. Iran, we know, has a lot of extra cash, and the Europeans really want to get a piece of it in any way that they can.
Have they ever done that before?
I'm not sure. I mean, they boarded it up with pretty tacky what type of wood
big
was
boxes.
It?
Yeah, I saw the
big boxes.
I saw the pictures.
Saw some pictures of that. But it just goes to show that they are not believing, the Italians are not believing that this is a more moderate Iran, a changed Iran that would be more accepting of maybe European values and accept that these are just different people with different values and we're willing to do business with them. No, they realize Iran still holds true to their core Islamic, realizes that they're still an Islamic state in that sense. They abide by that law. And they're doing anything they can to ensure that nothing jeopardizes those business deals.
This article details so many instances that show that this is going exactly the wrong direction. Iran wringing every ounce of propaganda that it can out of humiliating the American sailors on their knees at gunpoint by the IRGC. The fact that they continue to bankroll these terrorist groups, that the Shiite militias in Iraq, that they're giving cash weapons to these militias. There's just a whole lot of evidence to show that this is not going to have the effect that the president said that it would. I thought it was interesting, even it mentions this CNN report about Iran possibly being your next ski destination. There was an article that came out maybe 6 months ago saying that Iran was one of the cheapest vacation destinations in the world if you want to book your flight to Tehran. And here's CNN talking about what a deal it is to go skiing there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was in the Birmingham airport this morning when I arrived here in England, and just one of the placards for destinations for you to travel to, it was already up. Tehran was like number three in a row of Paris and another city, and there it is. Tehran is there, open for tourists, open for business in any way. I was surprised by that. I don't know whether they changed that recently or not, but it is being accepted as a legitimate world power in the company of nations, and yet they haven't done anything to change their behavior. We have this week as well, on Holocaust Memorial Day, we had the leader of the Iranian Shiite religion. He posted a video on his official website denying the Holocaust, and just another sign that they are unchanged. Also this week, Iran announced that they're going to have a cartoon contest about Holocaust denial, and the winner of that is going to get a prize of $50,000. And this article brings out that that's good sanction relief money that's being used well, that $50,000 as well, to promote Holocaust denial. I mean, this is at a time when the Jews are being persecuted everywhere around the world. And if you wanted Iran to give a sign, or if it cared to show the world that it had changed, then surely it would limit what it says about its Holocaust deniers.
You know, I thought Stephen Fleury did a great job on the program this morning. Going back to, I forget, it was a quote that Mr. Obama gave, I think it was in 2014, end of the year 2014, where he was talking about the fact that Iran's support for Hezbollah and for these terrorist groups did not diminish at all, despite the sanctions. And it was his view that as soon as Iran enters into these international agreements and begins to build more of a relationship with outside nations, that would be what would induce it to reduce its support for those groups. Basically, he said that those kinds of relationships are going to make it harder for it to buck international norms and so on, rather than saying, look, they're going to support these groups even when it's hurting their people, and they're very determined to do this no matter what is happening. He has this view that it's actually they're going to become more well-behaved once they have a lot more cash and so on. It's a remarkable view of this Iranian regime.
Right. We see that the absolute opposite is happening. I mean, Iran right now, it looks like they're heavily using the sanction relief money to tie up business contracts, especially with big foreign companies that have the support of their governments, because they know that if they get involved heavily with these European companies, then the likelihood of Europeans being able to snap back sanctions on them if they break the nuclear deal, that will be even more unlikely, because the Europeans are they're tying their hands to continue with Iran regardless of their activities.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review. We're looking at the most important stories from around the world, and we're going to turn now to Asia. Jeremiah, an interesting story out of Russia this week. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. Yes, Russian President Vladimir Putin is very skillfully using the memory of Joseph Stalin, the late dictator of the Soviet Union, to exhort the people of Russia to sacrifice. We've published an article in the Trumpet Weekly that was originally in Foreign Policy, and it's called For Putin, For Stalin. And this article does a powerful job of showing, first of all, how the memory of Stalin is being kind of retrospectively sanitized in Russia. No longer is he viewed as the tyrant who was responsible for the darkest chapter in Russian history. No longer is he seen as the man who is responsible for the torture and death of millions of his own people there under the Soviet system. The days of Russians remembering Stalin that way are coming to an end. And now he is starting to be seen more and more as a heroic figure. He is seen as the man who defeated Nazi Germany. That's the way that he's being painted more and more. And of course, Stalin's USSR did play a major role in the Allied victory there in World War II. But now that has become almost the only talking point for Russians when they discuss Stalin. And that's really dangerous historic revisionism. But there's plenty of evidence showing that it is happening. One piece of this evidence came in 2015 when the Soviet dictator's resurrected cult of personality really reached new heights. In May, the Communist Party officials in Lipetsk erected a brand new Stalin bust. And then a couple of months later, a village there opened a museum focused on his military exploits, just really lauding all of his military brilliancy there. And then in December, communist activists in the city of Penza opened a Stalin Center. The goal of this center was to, their stated goal is to popularize and implement the practices that were in use during Stalin times and are still relevant today. Pretty chilling purpose, I think, if you know a little bit about the history of Joseph Stalin.
Well, yeah, maybe you could just remind our listeners about, you briefly mentioned it, just what he was responsible for in the Soviet Union, what these individuals who are resurrecting his memory are overlooking, and I'm kind of interested, how much did they really even get away from that? We saw a really strong effort, say, within Germany, putting Nazis on trial and that type of thing. Obviously, we know that there was more going on behind the scenes, but in Russia, you really didn't have that kind of a departure from this history. So maybe the resurrecting that memory is less of a revolutionary change than it might have been, say, in Germany.
I think that's a great point. In Germany, you saw, at least on the surface, there was a very deep apology, just an attitude of great remorse for the Nazi atrocities. And there's all kinds of laws still extant today that outlaw denying the Holocaust and things like that. And just a nationwide remorse and repentance for the most part for that. But in the USSR, there was never anything of that kind. There was only a handful of high-ranking Soviet officials who were ever formally indicted for the various atrocities that happened. And those atrocities, it's still a murky picture. A lot of the data hasn't been fully come to light, really. But they know that millions and millions of people, anyone who spoke out against the Russian or the Soviet government in any way, was sent to the Gulag system, this really dark and brutal system of work camps and prisons. And there were just so many deaths. Any sort of dissident behavior or dissent against the regime there was brutally, brutally punished. And any sort of opposition was silenced. And at the head of all that was Stalin. So it's a dark chapter for Soviet history.
And we're talking, obviously, we talk about the millions that were killed in World War II, but the greatest number in terms of a national leader killing his own people, this was on a scale unlike anything that you saw in Europe. Can you give us a sense of why Putin would be drawing on this history?
Sure. Yes, he has a very good reason for drawing on this history. Basically, Putin right now is very alarmed by the economic decay that Russia is experiencing, and he's fearful of dissent. He's afraid that the Russians will reach a breaking point and start to blame him and his government's policies for their suffering. So he's turned to the ghost of Stalin to help rally the Russian people and to prepare them for the sacrifices that lie ahead. So basically, the message that he's sending out is clear. He's saying, just as Stalin did, Putin is going to take whatever steps he deems necessary to defend the country. There may be a lot of collateral damage along the way, but just trust him. It's for the good of Russia. He's saying, you know, Russians, just as your grandparents did in Stalin's time, you need to do whatever I ask of you. You need to trust that I do have the nation's best interests at heart, and you need to be willing to endure some suffering. You need to be willing to sacrifice, willing to withstand these difficult times.
And just judging by his soaring approval ratings, it seems like he's really tapping into something successfully within the Russian psyche.
It seems to be working really well. Some analysts do think that it's a strategy with an expiration date, though. They're wondering, how long can this go on as the Russian economy just continues to plummet? So far, it doesn't seem to be breaking into his approval rating, but it's difficult to know how long that could last.
Well, we're talking with Jeremiah Jacques on Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program. And in a sense, Russia isn't the only place that we're seeing a surge of interest in some of this communist history. Robert Morley, you have a story for us about what's happening in America.
Well, that's right. There was a recent study that came out and was taking a look at textbooks used in universities. And they ranked textbooks and books that were assigned by how many classes were required, you know, had these books as required reading. And a very interesting book came out in the top three. It was the third most popular book assigned in universities. And that book was The Communist Manifesto. The Communist Manifesto. This is the third. Yeah, this is the, that's right, written by Karl Marx, the third most popular book in universities in America. Very, very interesting. The only two books that were more popular were one was Elements of Style, which is basically an English textbook, and most students that go through university have to take an English class, so they get assigned that book, and then Plato's Republic. But after that, the most popular book was this book written by a Marxist communist that showcases communist ideals. And this, we have an article on thetrumpet.com titled "The Communist Manifesto Ranks Third in Assigned University Texts." And the author of this goes through and he talks about how this book is so popular because so many courses assign it as reading. And but then you can also look at books that are much more American or much more capitalist in outlook, and they are so far down the list, it doesn't even rank. Adam Smith's Wealth Among Nations, that's the 36th most popular book.
Well, is this are they actually supportive of these Marxist ideals, or this isn't a critique of Marxism, is it?
No, I wish it was. You would hope that it would be assigned as, you know, as reading, as like you said, a critique, but it isn't. It isn't that way at all. Thomas Sowell, he's a very well-known conservative author, and he's been describing this for years. This is what he said. He said, "During my years on the lecture circuit, I like to go into college bookstores across the country to see how many of their courses assigned the Federalist among books students were to buy as compared to how many assigned the Communist Manifesto and other iconic writings on the left, and he said that his survey always found that the Communist Manifesto was everywhere, but the Federalist was nowhere, and that's because universities, he goes on to say, you know, they aren't interested in teaching about the Constitution, about freedom. It's much more in vogue to learn about communism and socialism.
Well, thanks for that story. All right, let's go now to Richard over in the UK. And Richard, you have a story for us about the Pope and a very interesting apology that he just made.
Well, the Pope has been in the headlines a few times this week with his welcome of the Iranian leader. But more importantly, we're seeing a big push at the start of this year for Catholic unity. So this began on January 18th to January 25th. You had a week of prayer for Christian unity. And on January 20th, the Pope made headlines calling for unity, saying the mercy of God, which works in baptism, is stronger than our divisions. Then he published the details this week for the celebrations for the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation began in 1715, and there are going to be big commemorations of that. They'll begin on October 31st of this year. That's Reformation Day. And this week they published a common prayer that the Catholic and Lutheran churches both say on this day, on a joint service that they'll hold. And the Pope is going to travel up to Sweden, a very strongly Lutheran country, for this service. And they've got a service put together that talks more about Luther's original intention to reform the Catholic Church from within and not to start a new church. And so they're really emphasizing their common heritage. And then finally, and most dramatically, the Pope apologized for the persecution of Christians. He said, "I would like to invoke the mercy and forgiveness for the non-evangelical behavior of Catholics towards Christians in other churches." And he said, "We cannot cancel what has happened, but we don't want to let the weight of past harm continue to pollute our relations."
This is really, this isn't a new thing necessarily in some ways. This is really part of a trend that has been going on for quite a while with the Catholic Church trying to reconcile with some of these Protestant groups, isn't it?
That's right. And they've made some huge progress in recent years on a whole range of unity with a whole range of different churches. Basically, the Orthodox schism that was the division between the East and West, that's pretty much healed now. An Orthodox Christian can show up in a Catholic church and he's welcome for the service, can partake in all the communion and the sacraments, etc., and vice versa. And there's just really a tiny difference between the two on the exact nature of the Pope's role, but they're basically united. Over the past few decades, there have been major, major steps with the Lutherans, which is what we're seeing again at the moment. So already in 1999, they kind of solved what was the big disagreement that made Luther split from the Catholic Church nearly 500 years ago. The biggest point of that they've kind of solved now. They've signed a joint declaration on the understanding of what is meant by justification. So that agreement put aside. They also signed an agreement in 2007 with the Lutherans, the Orthodox, Methodists, Anglican, and Armenian Apostolic Churches in Germany, all recognizing each other's baptisms as valid. So they now recognize Lutheran baptisms along with a whole range of other Protestant baptisms. And then in 2010, the president of the World Lutheran Federation, which represents the vast, vast majority of Lutherans around the world, he said that in 2017, in this 500th anniversary, he wants to sign an agreement with the Vatican that would allow Lutherans to receive communion in the Catholic Church and vice versa. And if that is signed, that would basically end this Lutheranism split and go a great way towards ending the Protestant Reformation. So the Lutheran Church is really close to healing that split. Just to, very quickly, some other churches. You've got the Presbyterian Church in America. That, just a couple of years ago, signed an agreement with the Catholic Church where they recognized each other's baptisms as valid. And that's a major step because in the 19th century, you know, you had a lot of prominent Presbyterian ministers preaching very strongly against the Catholic Church. But they've made some big steps. And then even evangelical and Pentecostal groups, they've come a huge way recently. And these are some of the groups that are most different to the Catholic Church. But, for example, Joel Osteen visited the Vatican in 2014, and the Pope Francis held receptions with top American televangelists. Then he sent a recorded message to Kenneth Copeland Ministries a year or so ago. That's a big Pentecostal group. And they had a minister there said, "Brothers and sisters, Luther's protest is over. Is yours. And the Pope said, "I'm yearning that this separation comes to an end and gives us communion." So we've seen some really major steps now towards this unity. And what we see coming up in the course of this year and in 2017 could just complete the process that is really 80, 90% of the way there.
This Newsweek article, it really emphasizes the reconciliatory efforts that the Pope has taken with the Lutheran Church, and just how there have even been some more traditionalist Catholics within Europe who are say he's going way too far in this respect. But maybe you could just talk a little bit about how much these efforts that the Pope is making could have an impact on Europe more broadly. We've talked about the Vatican being a real unifier of Europe and really an important element of unification within Europe. Just talk about that for a bit.
Well, as you said, yeah, this is something that could really affect, you know, kind of geopolitical news, not just religious news. So the Roman Catholic, we've talked about the Catholic Church as a unifier, but the Catholic Church itself is divided. And you've got, for example, Germany is about 30% Catholic, 30% Lutheran. And a whole lot of Northern Europe is majority Lutheran, or that's the strongest kind of branch of Christianity there. And so for the Catholic Church to have a really strong role as unifier and bringing Northern Europe together with Southern Europe, which is where a lot of the big divide is within Europe, then it looks like this Lutheran Catholic unity would be a huge boost to that, both from just that practical point of view of then bringing in those vast populations of Christians in back to Rome, but then also just the huge prestige boost to the Catholic Church. I mean, Luther was the first, and Lutherans were the first Protestant church to break away from the Catholic Church. This is what started the Reformation, the divide that started this whole kaleidoscope of Christian churches that you saw. And so if you bring that church back, that would be a huge boost to the prestige of the Roman Catholic Church, a huge boost to its practical power, a huge boost to its people looking to it as a unifier, as somebody that can solve, a body that can solve centuries-old divisions. And so that would just really raise the stature of the Catholic Church dramatically.
We can definitely see the potential political implications of this within Europe in terms of its ability to unify. But we're also interested in this story because this is something that we've talked about relative to biblical prophecy. We have this booklet, He Was Right, and really a whole chapter about the unification of the Catholic Church with a reconciliation with its Protestant, the Protestants that came out of that church, something that we've been watching for quite a long time, many years, something that I would encourage any listener to go onto thetrumpet.com and get that booklet, He Was Right. And the name of that chapter, do you have that offhand, Richard?
I think it's Returning to the Fold.
Returning to the Fold. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, this story about why Pope Francis just asked Protestants for forgiveness is in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is a very informative report that we produce each week with the most significant stories from around the world. I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to this. If you go online to thetrumpet.com, you can join over 32,000 other subscribers who receive this every week. Coming up, we're going to hear about gender fluidity and why the great European experiment is failing, how terrorists are taking advantage of chaos in Libya. Later on in the program, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to start the second segment with a story about the radically changing moral climate of our English-speaking countries. Melanie Phillips has a strong opinion piece in The Spectator this week. Stephen Fleury talked about this some yesterday on the Trumpet Daily. Robert, tell us about it.
Her article is titled, "It is Dangerous and Wrong to Tell All Children That They're Gender Fluid." Now, she's talking about this new movement, if you can believe it, within our schools and within society in general, to disregard gender, to ignore gender. Gender is not important. Recently, the Commons Women and Equality Select Committee, this is a government sponsored committee in the United Kingdom, they produced a report saying that transgender people in the United Kingdom are being failed. And according to this committee, they say that people should be able to change their gender at will merely by fulfilling a form. And they go on to say that by merely asking or requiring someone to provide evidence that they've actually changed their sex is violating their rights. And they say that Britain as a nation needs to adopt what they call a self-declaration model, which is to say that you are whatever sex you want to be, whatever you want to be known as, regardless of your biology, you should be able to be that sex. And the government and society and everybody should treat you that way, regardless of what sex organs you have.
This is a pretty small minority of people here that are making some pretty radical changes. What are some of the other things that are happening in society within Britain, say, that Ms. Phillips is looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So this isn't something that's just within the political class. I mean, it does get a lot of noise at the political level. But this is something now that's getting into the school system. In Britain itself, children are starting to be taught, you know, as part of health education, this whole idea that about being gender neutral. First of all, they're teaching the children now, you know, that they need to be aware of the differences that people can be. They're not just male and female anymore. They're teaching the children that there's, you know, there's intersex people, there's transsex, there's polygender, there's asexual, there's neutral, there's genderqueer. There's all these things that children are having to be taught. So they're being, you know, in their health education classes and their sex education classes. But beyond that, they're being taught that males and females have no differences, whether it's their behavioral differences, attitude differences. There are no differences between genders. And if they say that, if they believe that, they're being bigoted. And that's basically the message that children are now being taught in the schools. Melanie Phillips is writing about this. She says that, quote, "The intention is to break down children's sense of what sex they are and also wipe from their minds any notion of gender norms."
So how are they implementing this, say, within curricula in schools? And every time I hear a story about this, I learn a new term. I've never heard the word polysexual before. But so how are they having teachers to instill these teachings within these kids?
Well, it just takes a lot of different forms. So, for example, this is at a little higher level. This is at Brighton College in Britain. This is one of their leading private schools. They've abolished all distinctions between boys and girls, whether it comes to, you know, referring to them in pronouns or in terms of dress code. So now they've changed their dress code. They said that males and females, they can wear whatever they want. Men can wear dresses. Women can wear, you know, trousers or whatever they want. So at that level, also at the younger level, they have various celebrations or awareness months where children are handed out, you know, things like buttons, various badges that identify themselves with specific personal pronouns, or they can choose no pronoun to identify. So, like, playing games with the children to try to, you know, to break the gender norms of society. You know, 6,000 years of human history, we are now trying to break down in our schools and abolish the very obvious differences between males and females.
Do you have any sense of how parents are responding to this?
That's a great question. I imagine some parents have to be just livid about this. But as you know, anybody who speaks out about these things, they're the bigot. They're the ones that get told that they're insensitive, they're behind the times, that they need to stop being, you know, so offensive, and how mean you are, how harsh you are, all these kind of things. And I think there's just people are being beat over the head with this, and the will to resist is just being broken down.
You know, we have this booklet, Redefining Family, and it just talks about how aggressive the efforts of certain activists have been to instill these kinds of policies. And there are just a lot of people who tend to have a hands-off, you know, let them do their thing and, you know, leave me alone. I'll believe what I believe, they believe what they believe. But it's amazing how quickly these changes have come about, and where you can't just be a passive observer, where your own children going to school, they're being taught these things, and it's you really don't have a say in it. And it's well beyond just kind of sitting back and watching this happen. It's definitely affecting society in a broad way. What we see happening in Britain is certain to spread to the United States, because you just can't. There's never a point where they're satisfied with, you know, we've come far enough. They're going to keep on pushing and pushing as hard as they can. Well, thanks for that, Robert. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We've been talking with Robert Morley. We're going to turn our attention back onto the world of geopolitics. We'll head back over to the UK. Richard has another article there about the Great European Experiment. Can you tell us about this, Richard?
Well, as all of our listeners will be aware, the EU has major, major problems, and problems really that can only be solved by coming together in a really strongly united European superstate. And Stratfor has this great historical analysis on what that takes and what is required for that kind of unity. And that's called Why Europe's Great Experiment is Failing. And the meat of this article goes back to Hobbes's Leviathan, this hugely influential book that Thomas Hobbes wrote around the time of the English Civil War. And his basic thesis was, you know, man in his natural state is evil. Without authority, there's going to be chaos. Man is going to kind of rob and pillage from his neighbor. And Hobbes's argument was, therefore, you need a strong government, even if it's unjust, to stop anarchy. And he called that strong government Leviathan. And this Stratfor article looks at that and says, well, you know, if you're going to have Europe come together and be effective, you're going to need a strong central government that has the ability to project force and to force unity among the different member states. And it talks about, well, there's no example in history ever of an empire coming together in kind of a voluntary collegiate way that you see Europe working today. And so the very logical but dramatic conclusion that this article comes to is that Europe is going to completely fall apart unless it creates this strong, militarily powerful central power.
It's a type of argument that isn't very politically correct. You're not necessarily going to hear European leaders use that kind of terminology, but really the pressure is there, even on European leaders, and they are saying it in not so many words, but that we need to have a more centralized government and in order to accomplish some of our goals, and we need to be more unified, and there needs to be more authority concentrated at the top.
Right, and I think it just takes an intensification of the crisis to happen. I think when you go back to 2008, 2009, where people genuinely thought that all the economic crisis in Greece might lead to total anarchy and collapse, there were nations around Greece developing contingency plans to send in their own armies into Greece to keep order. I think there were talks about sending in soldiers, you know, to keep the power on, to get medicines in there, or just to stop the disorder spreading over into other nations' borders. And that's the type, when you get that scale of crisis, I mean, it's diminished since then, you will see those kind of talks come up again. And we have seen that to a small extent in the migrant crisis so far. And that's something that's just going to dramatically intensify in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, I think this actually transitions nicely into our next item. We're going to talk about Libya and the fact of just what a chaotic country it is in absence of a strong leader. When Muammar Gaddafi was in power, he managed to hold that country together. But what we've seen since his ouster in 2011 is chaos. And what's happening in that void, Brent, we've been talking about a little bit, but we have a little update this week.
Right. We have been talking about this from the last couple of weeks on the Trumpet Hour here, the Week in Review, just because it is so important and it affects Bible prophecy heavily. It's featured well in end time events. Libya is, and its turn and switch of alliances and the new power that's going to gain control of that country. So it's important to keep on watching. And just this week, we had a report that came out by the Soufan Group. And this is a group that was founded by a former U.S. government official that investigated the 2001 terror attacks. What we've seen in this report is that it says that Libya is emerging as the new destination of choice for extremists, as both the Islamic State and al-Qaeda have used the chaos since Muammar Gaddafi left to, they've exploited that and grown in power. And Wednesday's report also talks about it becoming this new base for the Islamic State inside North Africa. It talks about how a lot of Islamic State's emphasis is shifting away from Syria just because the because part of the effectiveness of the air campaign, as well as some of the Iranian troops and such, and Syrian troops, Russian-backed Syrian troops over there, that we've got their shifting focus to Libya. They think that they can maximize on the chaos that's taking place over there without an effective government in place.
And Brent, just briefly remind our listeners about what we expect to happen in Libya going forward and how this might factor into that.
Well, the details of how something comes about to fulfill Bible prophecy are sometimes not included in the prophecy, although we would like them to be. But we do know that in the end time, we're going to have Iran actually align itself, or more importantly, get in control of Libya. And that's a prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. And this alliance probably comes together, you know, quite late in the end times. We've been watching for this to happen ever since 2012. Gerald Flory actually forecasted this before Muammar Gaddafi even fell out of power, before the Islamic Spring had really terrorized Libya and taken root there. And that was very exciting once we saw the chaos that ensued. And things are not getting better over there at all. Look for Iran to somehow capitalize on this chaotic state of Libya.
Well, thank you, Brent. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll move back to the United States and to an alarming story that's been developing in Oregon. It reached a head this week. Robert, take it away.
Well, just to bring you up to speed, there's been this standoff that's been taking place in Oregon. A lot of these militia types are there protesting what they feel is an overreaching big government that is oppressing states' rights and individual rights. And last month and month before that, it really came to the head where there was a dispute over federal land and some sentencing of some farmers, some ranchers out there who had a fire get away from them and burn some federal land. And since then, there's been a protest where militia groups from around the country, people who say they stand for freedom and smaller government, have come to protest on what they feel is a government that is oppressing them. And there's been basically a standoff on government land in Oregon. This week, it all seemed to come to a head. On Tuesday, some of the event organizers had left. They were heading out for some supplies, apparently. And the FBI and various law enforcement were waiting for them at a roadblock. These militia members, they decided they weren't going to stop for the police at the roadblock. They decided to go around it, and they ran off into a ditch. Their vehicles got stuck in the snow. There's video of this. The FBI were there. They had their helicopter videotaping it all. You can go online and see what happened next. But one of the individuals from the vehicle gets out and runs away from the police. From what the police say, he disobeyed orders to stand down. And he gets out in the field. And there's officers you can see coming from the sides, from the tree line, and also from the vehicles. And he initially puts his hands up in the air, looks like he's going to surrender. Then he makes some other movements with his hands. Police say he was reaching for a weapon. Supporters of the militia say that wasn't what was happening. It's very unclear from what I could tell from watching the video myself. But they opened fire on him. He is killed. They opened fire on other people in the vehicles. Some are injured. And now we have kind of this point where tension levels have reached new heights.
Right. This is just really an ongoing story, and we've reported on certain aspects of it over the years. But just this the way that federal law enforcement authorities are taking more and more power to themselves, and how an event like this happens, and it just really increases this sense of this out of control government, tensions between these militia groups, these say American Patriot type groups, the way that they're characterizing themselves, and law enforcement is just really reaching ahead. I mean, you see every one of these incidents, it just seems like it's building to a greater crisis point.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we're seeing a couple of things happening here. One is we are seeing, you know, this outgrowth of the distrust in government. We're seeing militia members, many of these people, You know, they aren't your typical redneck, got a million guns type thing. These are very Christian, family-oriented people. That
a lot of them ex-military.
Some are ex-military. There's definitely that wing in there as well. And we are seeing a rise in people who are concerned about the power of the federal government. They're looking and they're seeing things happening at that level that they don't think the Constitution provides for. And they don't like that. The other thing we're seeing here happening is we're seeing the discrediting of law enforcement agencies in America. And I think this is a very, very dangerous trend, whether it's the Black Lives Movement on that end, police forces being discredited in the minds of a big minority of people in the United States. And then also on the other end of the political spectrum here, we're seeing the same thing happen with federal authorities, not so much the local authorities, the local sheriffs and things like that. But on the other end, with these militia, it's the federal government that's being discredited.
Well, it is an interesting disparity there between, say, local law enforcement where that relationship with the local community is being eroded and the people are really losing their respect for local law enforcement, and then this sense of federal law enforcement being kind of getting out of control. And you do wonder, I mean, all of these things, the compromising the ability of local law enforcement to do their job and this sort of usurpation of power on the federal level, it just really does seem to be building. We have quite a lot on thetrumpet.com about this and about where this is leading, the biblical prophecies that this is fulfilling. And certainly just watching this happen, it's like watching these prophecies fulfilled in slow motion. Definitely something to keep our eyes on. Before we go to break, I want to pitch it over to our Asia man, Jeremiah Jacques, for a story from North Korea.
Yes, we've got 25,000 children in North Korea who are now suffering from severe malnutrition, and they require immediate treatment. That's according to a new report that was published by the United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF. And it says that the situation for North Korean children is getting worse because of a drought that has hit the nation and because the corrupt government has been reducing food rations for some of the neediest people. This drought was most intense during 2015, and it struck four of North Korea's most bountiful agricultural provinces really hard, and the result was about a 20% reduction in North Korean crops as compared to the previous year, and also a very significant reduction in North Koreans' access to safe, clean water. So experts say that the impact of this drought will continue well into this year, and they say that children and women are particularly susceptible to its effects. It wasn't very long ago that North Korea suffered a pretty much nationwide famine there in the 1990s that killed as many as a million people. And ever since then, the country has been relying heavily on foreign aid to feed its people. But this new United Nations report points out that whenever North Korea conducts an illegal weapons test, as it did earlier this month with what it claims was a hydrogen bomb, that foreign aid usually dries up or is greatly reduced. And so the international community wants to punish the terrible regime there, so they scale back funding. And that's easy to understand why it happens. But the problem is that it very seldom ends up punishing the regime. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's the poorest people, and especially the children, that end up suffering the most. So this is just another indication of how treacherous life is for the people of North Korea and just how desperately that nation needs to be liberated from that Kim dynasty.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. That's our weekly news report. The stories that we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week, and we'll start with Jeremiah.
I've got an update here about the China-Taiwan relationship. We talked in a previous show about the new president being elected there on January 16th with a landslide victory for the Democratic Progressive Party. And basically, this party wants more independence. They don't want to become a part of China the way the previous party was. And so now there's a Chinese general who came out and wrote a very powerful piece in the Global Times. He said, if Taiwan's separatist forces continue to press us into a corner, we will be left with no choice but to seek reunification by force. Then he said, Taiwan pushing for unification means peace. Taiwan pushing for independence means war.
All right, thanks. On to Robert.
Well, the world was supposed to end on January 27th. That was the day 10 years ago that Al Gore said that if we didn't end our addiction to fossil fuels, the world would come to a scorching end. That was part of that documentary, if you recall, An Inconvenient Truth, that he helped produce at that time. As we know now, the world has not ended. I'm sure we're all happy about that. But that claim was all based on the now famous Michael Mann hockey stick graph. You know, that graph that supposedly showed global temperatures declining for the last 1,000 years until suddenly the graph curves upward like the blade of a hockey stick. As soon as we hit the 20th century with fossil fuels, we now know that that graph was based on junk science, and that many of the organizations who have even pushed that in the past are now renouncing it. So I think that's the real inconvenient truth, that this world embraced something that the science did not show.
All right, we'll go on to Richard.
Germany's defense minister wants to spend another $140 billion on the German military over the next 15 years. Germany's economy is doing really well. They're generating a surplus of money. And so now people are talking about how they want to spend that money. That's what Germany's defense minister wants. The rumors are and the indications are that German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble approves of this and that he agrees. Schäuble is the second most powerful person in Germany behind Angela Merkel, is even being talked about as a potential successor to her if she goes down in the migrant crisis. So if he approves, it means that this is probably going to go through.
Well, I had an item here. The Fox Network started airing a new show this past Monday called Lucifer. The lead character is the devil. He's played by a handsome, charming British man. He got bored with ruling over hell. He retired to Los Angeles, where he runs an upscale nightclub. A beautiful pop star is murdered outside of his club, and Lucifer actually ends up helping the police solve crimes. So the devil's not such a bad guy. Actually, this show is based on a DC Comics character in which heaven is portrayed as an oppressive place. It's totalitarian, it's vengeful and dictatorial. And in the show, there's an archangel named Amenadiel, and God sends this angel to tell Lucifer that he needs to stop showing restraint and mercy. He needs to be evil because, quote, there's a balance here that we must maintain. So this is just a complete perversion of biblical truth, totally upside down from reality. The one thing they did get right is in portraying the devil as an attractive, alluring character, because that's what he is, and he's seducing people on a grand scale, and nonsense like this is a great example. We'll go now to Brent.
Iranian military officials announced on Wednesday that the country's forces had issued a serious warning to a United States warship in the Persian Gulf, chasing it out of that area, which the Islamic Republic of Iran had been conducting war drills. Apparently, they said that these two U.S. warships were sailing too close to the area where they were having their war drills, and they asked them to leave, and the United States Navy ordered their vessels out of the area.
And Richard?
Europe is starting to get a bit tougher on its migrants this week. So Denmark voted to confiscate assets from migrants worth more than $1,500 in order to pay for their stay. That's to discourage migrants coming to Denmark. Many German states are doing exactly the same thing. Sweden announced that it would be deporting 80,000 migrants over the next year who they say don't meet the qualifications to stay there. And then Germany on Thursday agreed to much more quickly deport migrants from North Africa. They designated Algeria and Tunisia, and I think one other country, as a safe country of origin. And they also voted, they've also put into force now where all migrants will soon have ID cards, and that will stop them being able to kind of roam all over the country with multiple identities and help the government keep much better track of them. And so you're starting now to get the specter of Europe forcibly deporting tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of migrants, forcing them onto planes, sending them to North Africa, where they don't want to go, it won't be long now before you'll see those kind of scenes on your TV, armed guards pushing crying women and children onto planes or onto boats, sending them to Africa if they follow through on what they said they're going to do. And that's something that would have been completely unimaginable just a few years ago. So you're already seeing Europe starting to change in the face of this crisis. It isn't enough to stop the crisis. We are definitely going to see a lot more change, but we are starting to see Europe make some steps in that direction.
And now to Jeremiah.
China has the cyber capability to take down the United States power grid. That is according to a report published this week by Admiral Michael Rogers. He's the head of the NSA, or National Security Agency. And he says, well, we've seen evidence before showing that China has already hacked into U.S. utility systems. And this report shows that they have the knowledge potential to really exploit vulnerabilities that they found in those systems and to shut them down or disrupt them. Rogers says, it is only a matter of the when, not the if, that we are going to see something traumatic.
All right, thanks for that, Jeremiah. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. What we've talked about on the program today, we packed all these stories into this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, and Richard Palmer.
Great to be with you
here.
And also Brent Noctegal. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of H.L. Mencken. The urge to save humanity is almost always only a false face for the urge to rule it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.